Thank you to the Henry Martin Center and to the Center for South Asian Studies for inviting me to speak here. It's an honor to do so. Writing in April 1947, in the run-up to Indian independence, Reverend Canon M.A.C. Warren, the General Secretary of the Church Missionary Society, discussed the problems and prospects of Indian Christians as citizens of a newly liberated country in which they formed a small minority of people. Appearing in the East and West Review, Warren's article framed the Indian situation as part of a global problem regarding the status of minorities in recently liberated countries which had weak or non-existent political, legal, and social traditions capable of securing religious freedom. Warren pronounced the prospects to be bleak and prophesied an inevitable period of suffering for such minorities, ranging from social discrimination to persecution and genocide even. His recommendation, however, was that Indian Christians should focus on religious freedom as a general principle and not on specific rights or privileges for themselves. This is because Indian Christians, according to Warren, were the only real Indians in a nation that was hardly a nation, rent as it was by cultural and religious divisions. Indian Christians, on the other hand, he said, because of their non-communal outlook, did not have to battle any deeper instincts in order to profess loyalty to the Indian nation. Thus, it was their true destiny, according to Reverend Warren, to seek religious freedom, not as protection against the state, but as a common good. On its own, this article could be dismissed as wishful thinking about Christian regeneration of a world that seemed to be going the other way, an irresponsible recommendation of self-sacrifice to fellow Christians situated at a comfortable distance. Its importance, however, lies in its summary of a political and religious attitude that had become extremely common among a key segment of Indian Christian leadership of the period. I will call this attitude the political theology of Indian Christian citizenship and suggest that it was an unusual but coherent and historically explicable answer to the question of how to be a minority in a plural society aspiring to be a democracy. Superficially, this was a chaotic idea, suggesting as it did that service and suffering, not rights and protection, and idealistic general leadership rather than defensive minority status should be the aspiration of Indian Christians. This noble and high-minded concept, like all such pieties, had very large blind spots. In the Indian context, this emphasis on suffering and selfless service implied a paternalistic and non-combative approach to social inequality, especially that of caste. Given that the vast majority of Christians in India came from Dalit or the most oppressed caste background, this was serious obtuseness. It also had crucial overtones of repression, both of male and female sexuality, which became explicit over discussions about Christian family law. Self-denial and self-control also provided models of political rectitude which specifically delegitimized an emphasis on community-specific rights. It is relatively easy to see why such an approach to being Christian would accord very well with broader nationalist trends. What is less obvious, and hence what this paper will attempt to explain, is why such ideas began to take shape long before nationalism itself had taken recognizably political form in India, leave alone win a significant following. In line with the excellent, if still slim, literature on Muslim congressmen, it's worth examining the ideas of Christian sympathizers of nationalism to understand how they reconciled their religious and political identities and what specific imperatives shaped such reconciliation. The first of these imperatives, I would suggest, is the need felt by elite Indian converts to Christianity to claim their religion as their own. Contesting the prolonged tutelage that European and American missionaries expected of their disciples. Here was a serious conflict of perception. Some of the best known 19th century Indian Christians belonged to the same radical social milieu as the metropolitan literati that we normally read about, in that they combined social rebellion with religious experimentation and frequently traveled from one to the other. It is clear from personal narratives that many of those who became Christian as part of this process saw their conversion in terms of their personal, intellectual, and spiritual journey, baptism marking their attainment of an elevated spiritual state rather than being born again into an infantile state requiring prolonged instruction. This explains perhaps the shrillness with which they disputed any aspersion on their capacity, professional or spiritual, and these two matters were constantly associated. Many of these disputes were petty quarrels over pay and managerial authority in churches and missions. But as Elizabeth Elburn has shown with reference to even more petty quarrels within the London Missionary Society in Cape Colony, such seemingly petty disputes could unfold much larger understandings regarding the proper relationships between European missionaries and their African co-workers, and explain the growing distance between the LMS, or what the organization that it was becoming, and African aspirations. In India, one such persistent bone of contention was over the distinction between the realms of the church and the mission. This was a racialized division sustained by a number of other reasonings. To take the example, the very important example, by the way, of the Church of England in India, the division was based on the purported purpose of the church and the mission, respectively. The Indian ecclesiastical establishment, paid for by the government of India, primarily existed for providing religious services to British expatriates. From 1813, this establishment was headed by the Bishop of Calcutta, the Metropolitan of India. Missions to natives, on the other hand, were not paid for by the government on the principle that the religions of the natives were not to be interfered with. Crucially, the principle of not patronizing missions was extended to mission churches or Indian congregations gathered by the missionaries as well. This made the Indian priests entirely financially dependent on the missionary societies, in the Anglican case, on the SPG and the CMS, which themselves in turn depended on private subscriptions. In the early 19th century, a young Bengali Christian called Krishna Mohan Banerjee found the situation unacceptable, and here you see him before he became bald and venerable. Krishna Mohan Banerjee was among the first, among the first upper caste Bengali converts to Protestant Christianity, and among the most important Indian Christians of the 19th century. He was a prolific journalist, a Sanskrit scholar, a member of the Asiatic Society, fellow of Calcutta University, and a founding member of the Nationalist Indian Association. His literary work was also vital in producing early Christian scriptural translations and exegesis in Bengali, and as professor of the Bishop's College, he trained several Indian priests in theology. Krishna Mohan was notoriously ostracized by his family for permitting a group of friends to organize a beef and wine party in the family home. When he eventually converted to Christianity, the CMS rescued him from destitution by finding him a job as a school teacher in 1832. By 1836, however, he was in irreconcilable conflict with his employers. He refused to serve a period of probation away from Calcutta on grounds of his own ill health, his wife's advanced pregnancy, his having already served an adequate probation, the inadequate salary proposed, and also because he was under instructions, he said, from the Bishop of Calcutta to remain in Calcutta and study for his upcoming ordination. In particular, Krishna Mohan questioned the authority of a partly lay missionary committee over him, a candidate for ordination who ought to have been under the sole authority of the bishop. After several bitter exchanges, the CMS Calcutta committee felt that it could not in good conscience support the ordination of a native Christian who would not prove his obedience by serving the period of probation, and dismissed Krishna Mohan Banerjee from the CMS's employment. Banerjee did have sufficient patronage from the bishop to be ordained as he had desired, and he was found a job as a pastor of a native church under the SPG. None of this, however, addressed the pervasive assumption that Europeans and natives, so-called, were different and ought to be treated as such. Inevitably, therefore, Krishna Mohan soon managed to disappoint his patron, Bishop Daniel Wilson. By refusing the post of a canon, in the new cathedral at Calcutta because he was offered, once again, a lower salary than European canons. Bishop Wilson urged that the Indian church could not afford an expensive clergy. Krishnamohan responded that the Anglo-Indians and poor Europeans could similarly not afford European chaplains, but were nevertheless supplied with them. Finally, Krishnamohan found suitable employment as professor in the Bishop's College, where he worked for 15 years. Not all were as talented nor as fortunate as Krishnamohan. In general, the salaries of Indian mission employees remained abysmally low, as can be seen in the table on CMS missionary salaries, mission salaries, in North India in 1866 to 67. So just hoping that is visible. You have on the extreme left the category of reader, and then the catechist and the head catechist, all these being Indian employees. Non-ordained, and then you have the CMS missionary on the other side. So the difference is quite stark in the salaries. Indians, by definition, could not be missionaries. As late as the 1910s, this remained the case, but around that year, owing to shortage of appropriate European personnel, a few highly educated Indian Christians were employed as missionaries, with European missionaries' salaries. But this limited experiment was discontinued within a decade following the recommendations of the CMS delegation to India in 1921-22. Henceforth, the native church and native church councils were made solely responsible for the salaries of Indian Christian university graduate priests, as in of the same social category as Krishnamohan Banerjee. This measure was represented as giving independence to the Indian churches. This was not an independence that thrilled the first Indian Anglican bishop, V.S. Azaria, who was appointed in 1913. He complained against such mission-church divide, saying that mission work was dominated by mission councils supporting the token Indian, while the Indian church councils were left in charge of impoverished Indian congregations. And it's worth mentioning here that Anglicans were not in the least isolated in maintaining this very common sense racial division of labor between missions and church. Very similar patterns are evidenced in the Scottish as well as American missions. It was not even clear that the so-called native churches could be allowed to be fully independent, even though that was the professed policy. In the first meeting of the Punjab Native Church Council, which was the effort to actually formally create these self-governing institutions, which was constituted under directives issued by the CMS in 1876, Indian Christians attending asked questions which may have showed their complete ignorance of basic episcopal principles or perhaps their alienation from them. Abdullah Thim, a government servant from Amritsar, suggested that all church officials, including the bishop, should be elected by the members of the church. Clearly, Athim's idea was considered too silly to even merit discussion. But when in the 1910s it was proposed to appoint V.S. Azaria the first Indian Anglican bishop by a more traditional route, his appointment threatened the neat racial division which separated British clergymen of the government's ecclesiastical department from the Indian clergymen tending to Indian flock. In the end, Azaria could only have an assistant bishopric with the special proviso that he would not officiate in the bishop's absence and would only exercise episcopal authority over the poor Telugu area of Dornakal being a missionary bishop, thereby sidestepping the possibility of Indian authority over Europeans even in the religious sphere. The question is, how did such experience color the attitudes of Indian Christians? Geoffrey Oddy has recently suggested that this experience of discrimination may have pushed at least some of the early elite converts to Christianity towards anti-colonial nationalism, a move further facilitated by the liberalism of the early Indian National Congress. While this appears very plausible, I think there is a more direct and sustained connection between the experience just described and a widely observed feature of Indian Christian culture, which is its theological liberalism. It is to the politics of that liberal theology that I turn next. The liberalism of Indian Christian theology, in the sense of its active toleration, respect, and incorporation of key concepts and possibly doctrines from other religions, especially Sanskritic Hinduism, has been commented on by several scholars. Lionel Kaplan, in studying the reasons for the recent success of Pentecostal missions in Madras, commented on the alienation of the vast majority of Indian Christians from the dominant liberal theology of the Church of South India, the ecumenical Protestant Church, which is in communion with the Church of England. Dalit theologians since the 1980s have stridently denounced this Sanskritic theology, which they say has failed to address the aspirations and needs of the vast majority of Indian Christians. In historicizing it, Anthony Copley and Geofordy have seen it as symptomatic of a broader cultural process, the effort of elite upper caste converts to Christianity to reconcile India with the West and at the same time to assuage a guilt born of abandoning their intellectual and spiritual roots. Today, I will wonder out loud whether this marked pattern of affirming a decidedly Hindu past by these admittedly elite Indian Christian thinkers may not also be read as a protest. The issue of religious translation and of politics over it is, of course, a broader one. Nobili's brush with the Inquisition in the 17th century had revealed both the necessity and dangers of culturally relocating doctrine. But too little attention has been paid to the crucial but precarious role performed in this process by those cultural intermediaries, the class of native assistants to which Krishnamohan belonged. These people often had very different imperatives to the one that motivated their missionary employers. The much-studied struggles over caste in Indian churches and its ultimate prohibition by European Protestant authorities in the mid-19th century were part of that broader question of what precisely were the cultural, social, and moral correlates of Christian confession. In his detailed study of the split of the SPCK's Tanjore congregation in 1829 and the excommunication of the Christian poet Vedanayagam Pillai, Dennis Hudson has suggested a conflict between different ways of being Christian, a Western one and what he calls a Malabarian one. In a humble address to the missionary authorities in London, Pillai did comment on the wrongheadedness of the reformist missionaries and their obsession with what he saw as irrelevant social customs. He criticized those, in quotes, who should preach on the faith of the Son of God, but preach now all the day long, more than 10 times, on the subject of eating with the pallar and parayar promiscuously. Although the periods of their scholarship overlapped, Krishnamohan belonged to a different socio-moral universe. Whereas Pillai's defense of caste may be seen as the product of a tenacious traditional social vision, Banerjee began and ended his career by denouncing caste, and in this he may be said to be of a piece with reformist Hindus, who all agreed in theory that distinctions based on birth alone were illegitimate,